Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk by Lama Kathy Wesley is entitled The Six States of Existence. According to the teachings of the Buddha, we are all evolving every moment of our lives. We and other sentient beings, called Drowa in Tibetan, are always in motion, trying to find happiness and be free of suffering. This talk describes the classic Buddhist teaching on the six states of existence and how meditation helps us evolve from lower states of suffering to self-aware states of awakening. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. I know that a lot of people are moving around a lot because it's spring break. When I came home from our home monastery at KTD, when I came home from KTD this week, I was sitting next to a couple of OSU students, and they were finishing their spring break or getting ready to be. Anyhow, they were doing a spring break thing. And so for me, it was it reminded me a lot about college and how our life is always on some kind of calendar, right? We're always going and coming and doing what we do because of what the time tells us. In a way, you could say we're sort of slaves to the clock. We have to get up in the morning. We have to get ready, go to work, go to school, take the kids to daycare, or whatever. We just have to keep moving. And from morning to night, it's like we're in this situation of constant movement. And so I think today, that's what I'm going to talk about is the Tibetan word drowa, those who move, because that's our condition. That's our condition. You've heard, no doubt, discussions of the what they call the six states of existence. And these are states that are sometimes depicted as being realms or places. In fact, you can see them on depicted in paintings as the six realms of this world, where they talk about the world that is on the earth, the world that is below the earth, and the world that is above the earth. Those are just words to describe really where we are at any given time of the day. So you can see this description of the six states of existence, the six realms of existence. You can see them either as real places that exist somewhere, or you can see them as states of mind that we go through from hour to hour, from minute to minute. Hi there. I just want to say we have a lot of friends here today. So it's like, hi guys. I just want to like wave at all of you. I just came, how many Michaels do we have in the room? We got one, two. Okay. Okay. Yeah. We have, how many James do we have in the room? We have several. Anyway, but, it's great for you guys to be here. But these are states that we go through, every day. And in fact, some people have told me that in the morning they feel like they're undergoing a reenactment of human evolution, according to the scientists, right? According to the scientists, all life began as small, bacterial creatures and then one-celled organisms, and then they sort of began to, grow arms and legs and be able to move. Although amoebas do move, but just a different way. Now I'm thinking Bob Fosse, doing, amoeba choreography. So whether you're a one-celled organism or you've got arms and legs and moving around, you feel like you're always on the go. And some people say their mornings are like that. They kind of open their eyes and they realize they haven't had any coffee, and they realize they're really tired from the night before, and so they're sort of like the beginning phases of life. And then they sort of drag themselves out of bed, wash and get ready for work, and then slowly they become almost like civilized human beings. They drink their coffee or their tea, they have their breakfast, and then they're somehow ready to meet the day. And so they've undergone an evolution. In fact, I know a friend of mine who says to their housemates, please don't interrupt me until I'm fully human, which will happen after coffee. So the idea here is that, as you can see from our morning example, the example of a person's morning, we're not always totally ready all the time. And we do need time to adjust ourselves to the day and to our activities and so forth and so on. And so in this way, you could say that you are a lower life form when you first open your eyes, and then you're a higher life form when you begin to interact. So in that way, you've gone through a few, shall we say, you've gone through a few states of life just in the phase of an hour or hour and a half in the morning. Yes, you moved from one room to another, but your mind moved from one state to another. And that way, you actually are somewhat of a different person when you are ready to meet the day as you were when you first opened your eyes. You could actually say you're a different person. Because if nothing else, you've had some cell death and all of that kind of thing. So technically you are a different person, cell by cell by cell, than you were when you first woke up. But that's too technical. What we have to think about is where our minds are. The body is going to do what the body is going to do, but where is our mind and what kind of existence are we experiencing? And so this is why someone asked me yesterday, well, why do people bother to practice meditation? What's the point of meditating? And it really comes down to having what I would call a thread or a through intention, a thread of an intention or an intention that goes through the day. Kind of like those signs that say through traffic only. You know, there's like a continuous thread of some kind of awareness that goes through your day. And that thread of intention and awareness and intention and so forth just goes through your day. And meditation helps you to fashion that, to mold that, to create that. When we don't have that sort of through story or thread of intention and so forth, what we have is more of a pinball existence, where we're like those balls in the old pinball machine or in the billiard table when you break a set of billiard balls, and they just go bouncing here, 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 here. And it looks like there's no organization, there's no story, and there's no meaning, and everything is just kind of bam, 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 bam. And that's how we feel a lot during the day. And so yesterday I had the pleasure of meeting a number of, this group was all men, who were martial arts students, because yesterday was the fundraiser that the martial artist Stephen Hayes put on for us. And he teaches Toshinbo, which is a Japanese form of martial arts. And he also teaches a Go Shinbo, which is a mental attitude training. And when he was giving his mental attitude training, it sounded very much like the Bodhisattva path. Those of you who are familiar with Buddhist terminology know that Bodhi means awakening, a person who's awakening from the sleep of ignorance, ignorance about the interconnectedness of all things and the impermanence of all things. We've awakened from the sleep of that ignorance. The sleep of that ignorance makes us those billiard balls that just go boom, boom, boom with no reason. And so he gave the people of guided meditation. And in his guided meditation, he said, okay, you have a lot of self-identifiers. You identify as a certain gender. You identify as a certain age. you identify as a certain nationality or type of person. You identify as this or that. And he said, but really who we are at the base is someone who wants to help. And when we want to help, where we're from doesn't matter. What gender we are doesn't matter. What our nationality is doesn't matter. Our age doesn't matter. What matters is our wish to benefit others and our wish to help others. And so he guided these amazing martial artists. There were like I say, about 10 of them in the room. And he just had them all sit quietly and he guided them through this slow removal of labels from themselves. You're in a situation, he says, where someone needs help and someone with a clipboard is there asking you questions. What is your name? I don't need a name. I'm just here to help. What's your nationality? I don't need a nationality. I'm here to help. And so he walked them through this amazing list of identities that we could try on and then set aside, because it all comes down to that through story, that thread, that central thread that he said is in all beings. They want to help. All beings want to help others, and they're trying to get the techniques and the tools so they can do it. For some people, they want to help themselves. They want to get out of whatever situation they're in. For other people, they want to help other people to work with their situations and to be better and have what they need. And this wish to help is the through story, if you will, the reason for being, the purpose of a person who is following the Bodhisattva path. And so for those people, we may go through all of these different stages of life. We may be one-celled organisms as we wake up, and we may have to get our tea, coffee, food, and then we can be civilized humans. But what we really are people who want to help. We want to be of benefit to others. And at the very least, we want to be able to live well and benefit ourselves and to live well and benefit those who are close to us. And then gradually, as we practice the Bodhisattva meditation, we slowly come to understand that there are others in this world and they're suffering and so on. And so it is said that, as I have said, the Tibetan word for sentient being is drowa or trowa, and it means those who go. And Kempo Carter Rinpoche explained once why they have this name. He said, it is as though we are part of a restless, ceaseless caravan. Now, I know that's a loaded word these days, but we are part of this this movement of both human, insect, bird, life. Everybody is going somewhere doing something. And Rinpoche said, where are they going and what are they doing? They're just going. You see them on the highway, the red tail lights heading toward work. And then in the morning and heading toward home in the afternoon, where are they going? You brush an anthill and suddenly scores, thousands of ants, they're all moving and they're all going somewhere. The bees, they're all going somewhere. The birds, they're all going somewhere. The squirrels are going somewhere, sometimes around in a circle, but they're going. And so everybody is going somewhere. And he said, what's the reason? The reason is they want to feel better. They want to be happy. They want to feel safe. They want to feel secure. They want to have the things they need. So they are looking for that. They're seeking it. They're looking for it. The birds flying in the air. This week I had the interesting experience of driving home at the my plane landed before the frontal system arrived on Thursday. And so I was driving east, essentially ahead of it, to go home. And when we got to Licking County, where I live, I could see in the sky that in the unsettled winds ahead of the front, there were dozens of turkey buzzards enjoying the surf. They were surfing. They were doing the bird equivalent of surfing. They were moving and they were wheeling from side to side, clearly enjoying the unusual weather. Now, why would they do that? Because they want to feel better. They want to feel alive. They want to feel happy. And so they're up there probably showing off to one another, probably doing whatever other people do when they're trying to enjoy themselves. And so this is what we're all doing. The problem is sometimes we run into each other when we're doing this, and there's conflict. Because we want to be happy one way, somebody else wants to be happy another way. And sometimes those wishes collide. And when those wishes collide, we have the moment of shock from the collision. And then instantly, we start to think, why? Why did I have a collision? And then often the next thought is, whose fault is this? Whose fault is this? It can't be my fault. I was watching where I was going. I was minding my own business. And then somebody else trying to be happy collided with me. And then we start to form, shall I say, unusual ideas about other people. We think, well, it's they're in my way because of this, or they're in my way because of that. And they need to get out of my way so I can continue and be happy. And this is really the world we're living in all the time. And so we're always judging ourselves, we're judging others. And in this judgment, we're causing problems. Actually, we're making the problems we already have worse because we're putting a wall between us and other people of blame. That wall is our blame of them for being what they are. And we're putting that wall between them and us so there's not clear communication. And there's no solution, because how can you solve something when you can't get through? So I think that this tells us why meditation is important. At the dinner last night, after this martial arts class, there was a lot of really good talk around the table. And because many of these people had never met. These 10 people, many of them had never met. 3 of them came from Boulder, 1 came from Utah, another came from California, another came from Washington State, another came from North Carolina. They came from everywhere to have this martial arts class with Stephen Hayes. And at dinner, they were getting to know one another and trading stories and bits of wisdom. And one of the people said to me, well, why would I meditate? Why would that be necessary? I mean, I'm kind of afraid that if I meditate, I'm going to chill out so much. I'm going to be like those heroes of the reggae movement, Bob Marley and all those other people who just kind of say, hey, man, whatever, you know, and I won't care anymore. And I said, well, I got some good news for you. You care now, so that's not going to change. But how you care is going to change. Just because you're not being a judgmental in a negative, punishing way towards somebody else, because this person had just told the story of how they had been bullied as a child and how their coach said, look, if you want to go beat that kid up, first you got to run around the track a few times and get a little less angry. Come on, let's kind of work that out of you. And he basically said, don't let another person change who you are. And don't let them turn you into something you don't want to become. Because the guy was said, I was so mad at that bully, I wanted to beat him to a pulp. And I didn't think I would have stopped if I would have started. And he said the coach saw that. And he saw that I was going to actually be a danger to myself as well as to this other person. And so he said, run it off. Run it off first. See, are you any less mad yet? And so forth. He said, he sent me around the block. The track wasn't enough. They had to send me around the block. And I was still mad. And he said, so what he eventually said was, look, this is not going to solve your problem. This beating this other kid up is not going to solve your problem. It's going to turn you into somebody you don't want to become. How do you think he got that way? He said. So everybody's learning. Everybody's always learning. We're always learning from each other. So around that table, people were learning from one another. And I said, this proves my point. You're not going to become like Bob Marley and just say, hey, Mon, whatever. And, you know, don't worry about anything and so forth and so on. You're actually, although making good music would be awesome, but you're going to actually still care. Meditation just allows you to place your attention on a single object and notice when you have wandered from that single object, and then gently, that word is important, gently bring your attention back to the breath for a fresh start. And doing that over and over and over again is going to train your attention so that you have the capability to question your assumptions when you make them, to question your blaming, judging mind. Is this person really that, which I have said they are? Is this person really just suffering? Is this person really just trying to go about their happiness in a different way than me? What is my best response to this person in the moment? Who do I want to be in this person's life? When we slow down through the practice of meditation, we can make better choices. That's the theme. That's the idea. And so that was one of the conversations that happened around the table. Meditation helps us as we are making this evolution from one form of life to another. Another person at the table described how they had been they had actually been a bully when they were in school. And learning the martial art helped them to restrain themselves and to realize what other people are thinking and feeling. And so the martial art actually helped them to be a better person, because it wasn't just about fighting someone and winning. It was about who are you inside and who are you going to be and who is going to be your master. Are you going to be the master of yourself, or are you going to let your emotions be the master of you and run you wild, like that poor kid had to run around the track so many times? So these states of existence we go through each day. We go through these states of existence trying to be happy. And if we can see that the people we collide with are also just trying to be happy, that will help. The gentleman I spoke to, by the way, last night, who had been bullied and beat up, he basically said he's still mad. He's still nursing that grudge after 20 years, 30 years. And when he spoke about the young man, he said, we actually met each other as adults. One day we were passing each other in a store. I was coming into the store, he was going out of the store. And he stopped me and said, oh, hey, buddy, how are you? And he talked to him like he was a friend and not the guy he had beat up. And he said, I came to find out that he had had a terrible life. Everything went wrong for him. And he said, I couldn't help but feel some satisfaction. And I said, still so much to learn, grasshopper. Still so much to learn. I said, maybe you need to stop carrying that grudge. It's getting a little heavy, don't you think? And taking joy in the fact that he had misfortune in his life is actually not helping you. It's actually changing who you are inside. Remember what the coach told you? Don't let a fight with somebody else or with change who you are. Let you be who you are, and don't let somebody else change who you are. And so I said, this kid is obviously still impacting you 20, 30 years. Maybe it's time to feel compassion for him. Oh, yeah, I already did that. And I'm like, really? Did you really already do that? I said, well, then why are you still mad if you've done all the compassion stuff? And he said, well. And I said, well, how about this? How old were you when this happened? And he said, I was 14. I said, okay. So I want you to, in your mind's eye, imagine that teenager who beat you up. Imagine that teenager as being a four-year-old child. So why would I do that? Well, because something happened to that child. He was sweet and innocent. Something happened to him to turn him into the kid who beat you up. Something happened to him, and we all know what it was. Somebody treated them badly. Somebody beat him up and made him feel that he was small and that the only way he could feel of any good size would be to beat somebody else up. And I said, so pray for that little boy who he had been. And that kind of made him stop just for a second. I said, look, I'm just asking you to question. I'm just asking you to question the necessity of holding that anger. And anger is not fixing anything. He says, well, my anger is good. It helps me to get work done. And I said, yeah, but what's the cost? Who's it turning you into? So what I could say is that the dinner ended as a bit of a downer last night. I kind of like felt bad about that and, you know, did some purification mantra on the way home because I actually kind of did go too far. You got to just give, when you think you're never going to see somebody again, you throw everything at them and it's like, maybe that wasn't the right thing to do. But by the same token, he was going through a state in his life. Oh, I haven't told you the six states of existence yet. I probably should fill that little bit in. When the Buddha taught about the six states of existence, he taught them as real places in a giant universe. But really, I like to think of them the way that Chogyam Trungpa talked about them, as being states that humanity, human minds go through and they're sort of stacked one upon the other. The lowest state of existence is the state that's produced, and each one of these states is produced by a predominant mental affliction. That is, not just something we feel for a moment, but something we kind of work on. Something we kind of say, yeah, about. Like we have an angry thought and we go, yeah, I need that. I need that. That's good for me. I want that. Well, if we do that enough, then we kind of feel like we're on fire all the time because there's always something to be mad at because that becomes the habit. The habit is being mad. And so what we do then is we feel like we're on fire, and the Buddha said that's like being in hell. So that's the first of the low states that a person's mind can go through. A lot of people have told me that they have spent a lot of time in hell in their life, one way or the other, and that now they're out of that and they're in a different place and they feel better. Well, the second of the lower states we can be in is the state of continuous hunger and thirst, I say as I drink my water. The state of continuous hunger, whether it's hunger for food or for praise, or for fame, or for accomplishment, or whatever. It's I kind of think of it as like being addicted to something, some good feeling that you get when you eat or drink or accomplish something. But you never get enough. The person who feels they never have enough, the Buddha's teaching was that they're sort of in the realm that's created by this stinginess, this miserliness, this inability to share, and it's called the realm of the hungry spirits. The next one above that is the realm of animals. And we've all had what one teacher once called animal meditative absorption. Late at night, we should be going to bed, but we're either watching a tube or we're playing a game and we just kind of zone out. And that's kind of the result of what I would call chosen ignorance, where you know what's good for you, but you do something else. And then there's our realm, the human realm. And you know what they say it comes from? Obsessive attachment. Really? Obsessive attachment? Moi? Of course, we're all obsessed about something, and we're attached to things and feelings and people and everything. We're attached, attached, attached. So welcome to our world. And so by the way, in the text, when they talk about the human realm in text, they call it the realm of continual toil and poverty. So they've seen our lives, obviously. The Buddha saw our life, continuous toil and poverty, because we are obsessed by things. In fact, I remember in The Great Path of Awakening, they talk about four obsessions, and one of them is entertainment, but let's just not go there for now. And then there are what we would call the next higher states of existence. And one of them is, I would call it the fighter. Now, you may know people in public life who are like this. All they do is fight. They like to fight. And they like to be famous for fighting. And they're so good at fighting, they want everybody to fight with them. And they don't want to be alone. They want to keep fighting. Fight, 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 fight. And so the fighters, the people who always feel like somebody got their thing and that they need to fight to get it back, they're fueled by jealousy and wanting what other people have. And that results in the state of existence that the Buddha called the jealous gods. Because there's a legend, there's an ancient legend about in Asia about a tree that's rooted in one realm and it flowers in the other. And there's flowers and fruit in the other realm. And so the people who are tending the roots of the tree think the fruit belongs to them. And then the people who live right next to the fruit say, hey, that belongs to us. It's on our side of that fence. So it belongs to us. And they're continuously fighting over it. And that's the legend. Those of you who are familiar with Star Trek Deep Space Nine, this is a plot that is in the, I think it's in the first season. Anyway, okay, so anyhow. Anyhow, yeah, it's in Deep Space Nine. I forget which, anyway. Anyhow, it's a long story. They go to this planet, and then there's a war going on and between the haves and the have-nots, and they keep dying, and then they keep being revived and having to, I forget which episode it is. But anyway, and then the spiritual teacher from Deep Space Nine goes and stays behind. I think it was Deep Space Nine. Anyway, so anyhow, because they're a bodhisattva, and they want to help the people who keep getting killed. It's a cool episode. Anyway, a lot of Buddhism there. But then the highest of the states of existence we can experience is is what I would call the experience of superiority. Now, maybe you don't feel superior on some days, but maybe you do. I have to tell you a story. A friend of mine, she would come over and help me with things around the house. And she liked to watch television while she worked. And she would always watch the true judge shows, where people go and they argue in front of a judge. And I say, why do you watch that? Because it's just people yelling at each other. And she says, oh, I like to watch it because I realize I'm not that stupid. I'm not as stupid as the people who are arguing in front of the judge. I say, oh, so that's why you watch it. So that you can feel like you have a little superiority. And she says, well, I never thought of it like that. Anyway, I know how to ruin everybody's fun. Do not invite me anywhere. Sorry, Buddhist teachers are just like totally no fun. Sorry. Yeah, I know. I'm really a party killer. I'm sorry. Anyway, it's kind of like the job, I guess. But anyway, so the highest realm is this realm of feeling superior. And wouldn't you know, there are times when you feel superior, it's almost like you're floating on air and like you're above it all. And then, of course, somebody gives you a bit of truth and then you go plummeting to earth. But this is why they call this the realm of the gods, because this is for people who really suffer from pride and arrogance. I'm one of these people, therefore, it's a problem, because then they put me on this seat and I got to talk to people in front of people. And it's like, it's really heck sometimes because, you got all this pride and then people ask you questions and sometimes you know the answers. It's freaky. It's actually kind of creepy, but at least I'm doing the best I can with what I got. So anyway, there's that. Sorry, I'm just reading the shirts in the front row. You guys are awesome. So these six states of existence, we may actually go through them all in one day. We may get up feeling like we're kind of in hell, and then we may be super hungry and eat breakfast, and then we may kind of like zone out in front of the tube for a while or reading the news or whatever, and then we go through obsessive attachment, shopping, and then after that, we go through all the other realms of existence, even in a single day. But there are days when we kind of feel like we're stuck someplace. Like we're stuck in hell, or we're stuck in obsessive attachment, or we're stuck someplace. And this is where the Buddhist teaching on meditation comes in handy. Because remember that technique in meditation where you're watching the breath, and then you notice that you've wandered from the breath, then you notice it, you let go of the wandering, and then you return your attention to the breath. The moment you do that, whatever you were thinking about, poof, it's gone. It vanished. And I said this to the people at the table last night. I said, where'd that stuff go? And they're like, that's right. I said, where does it go? Does it go back into central casting? Where do all those thoughts go when you let them go? When you let them go, in meditation, they literally disappear. So like, what were we getting worked up about? Again, what were we getting worked up about? And so this understanding that thoughts are discontinuous, this understanding that our idea of who we think we are and who we think others are is always changing and evolving, and the understanding that those six states of existence are what other people who are sitting next to you in the room today are going through. They're actually going through one of these six realms right now. Right now. Excuse me, I'm doing the hungry ghost realm here. Let the record show that's a great cup of tea. But so we're all going through it. And if we can understand that, and if kindness is our through story, then everyone we know is carrying a burden. That's what the saying says. We should be kind to everyone because no one knows the burden that other people are carrying. And so that's what I wanted to talk about today, was just this idea that everyone is carrying some kind of burden in their life. And it doesn't mean that we should allow people to be evil. That's not what I'm saying. So I'm not saying we should allow people to insult and harm and abuse other people. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that we should try our best not to hate them for it. Because when we hate them, we're turning ourselves into something. You can almost feel what that hate feels like inside you. And if you can set that aside and instead feel some compassion for the little children they were before something happened to turn them into something else, that's really what has helped me more than anything in my life, is to be able to step back. And that's what meditation allows you to do. If you can step back from a single thought, you can step back from a story. And if you can step back from the story, you can take the higher view and hopefully work on that through story. Who am I going to be in this moment? Am I going to be the helper? Am I going to be the person who is here to help? Am I going to be the person who is here to win a fight? Who am I going to be in this moment? And this is what our training is all about in Dharma. And I could probably go and say lots more stuff, but I realized I talked way more than I should have. But and then I have some news for you at the end here. But I just wanted to talk about these states of existence because I've been through a few, and it's only noon. And so I think that what we could do for like the last, maybe for the next 10 minutes is just have discussion. The question microphone is open. Believe it or not, these talks are recorded. You can find us on iTunes, right? Columbus KTC? Okay. And you can listen to us when you're not here. And so you can line up if you want to, and I would ask everybody to start with asking one question, and then we'll see if everybody is done. Then you can come back and ask a second question. So, but if nobody has a question, we will meditate. Questions? What state of existence are you in today? Yeah. Yeah, you got a question? I see you getting up. Well, let's pretend you're not first. Okay, I'm going to ask the first question. I'm going to go ahead and get in line. I'll ask the first question. The first question is, why? I never really did answer this this man who asked me, well, why meditate? Why? And it's because our minds are like those billiard balls or pinballs. They're always going to and fro. And unless we slow them down, they're going to run away with us. I don't know if you've ever had your temper run away with you. I have, just in the last day. And how can we slow that down? By learning how to let go. So I asked the first question, so you're up.
That was
good. Yeah, all right.
Quite as
impressive. All right, there you go, yeah. By the way, happy St. Patrick's Day. I see some St. Patrick's, this is awesome. I will tell a brief story, and that is that today's my wedding anniversary.
Happy wedding anniversary.
Yeah, I was just like a teenager when I got married. It's a long story. I was 19 when I got married. I'm not that young. Anyway, I wanted to get married on Sunday, the 18th of March, but the priest, I was a Catholic at that time, wouldn't marry us on that day. So we had to get married the Saturday before, and I begged my two bridesmaids. Yeah, it was a big wedding. My two bridesmaids not to buy green dresses, but they did. So there you have it. Yeah, there you go. And it snowed, by the way. It snowed like 5 inches on my wedding day.
I guess it must have worked because they were like incarnations of green tar.
Oh, no. Yeah, there you go. I like that. Yeah. Where's Marilyn? Marilyn's wearing a little sequined green hat today. Sir.
So for some reason, this got me thinking about mind training and the slogans. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you some context afterwards. Are the mind training slogans organized in a way to address each one of these states? And the reason I ask is because I was thinking about this while you were talking. Mm-hmm. I go off on tangents sometimes, but it's like when you become a Dharma practitioner for a while, it's almost like you get put in the stew pot and then you get taken out of it. And then it's like you've got these mantras and stuff, and it's almost they talk about, in Western psychology, a psychological schema. And it's like your brain gets rearranged be in a certain state, so you're not attached to stuff and, you're on the cushion. And then you get off the cushion. And then it's like, oh, there's the compassion mantra. There's green tara mantra. Right. Oh, and there's a slogan. And it's almost like it kind of reprimes your schema and kind of redirects you back to that state of being on the cushion or, whatever. So then you're not wanting to I don't know.
Act out, react.
Yeah, punch someone in the throat, whatever you want to. Yeah.
I endorse that statement.
Which one?
The idea that when you are on the cushion, you're cultivating that schema. I've got to learn this one. I kind of skipped that day in psychology
theory,
class.
The idea. I think I'm not a psychologist or whatever, but the idea that we've got these switches in our brain, FN statements.
Okay.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Pretty cool. So, we sort of change, in other words, we change some of our software around to be more kind and be more understanding and be able to be less reactive and angry.
Right.
And as we're changing that, when we get off of the meditation seat, because the meditation seat is like a controlled environment. We can sort of control the environment when we're sitting, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if the dog wants to sit in our lap, I mean, what can you do? But or the cat wants to do this thing, But I have people tell me that when they attempt to sit with their pets, it sometimes can be really, really, really interesting because the cat will the person is sitting and the cat just takes the paw and paws at the chin, are you alive? Yeah, hey, look, I can make them do this anyway. When we get off the cushion, then we have all these techniques.
Right.
And you're right, the mind training slogans, the 59 mind training slogans of the book, the 7-Point Mind Training and The Great Path of Awakening, those are two books written on the 59 slogans. They are meant to be reminders. Mm-hmm. In your everyday life. Just like yesterday, instead of fortune cookies at the end of the meal, I gave everybody a number, and it was one of the verses from the 37 actions of a bodhisattva.
Oh, wow.
And I just picked them at random, but I actually did put two in there that I thought that they should hear.
Oh, wow.
And different people drew different ones, and we had a great time.
Okay.
But like the one that I wanted to put in because everybody had been talking about anger. And the one verse is verse 20. If you have not tamed the enemy of your own anger, combating outer opponents will only make them multiply. Therefore, with an army of love and compassion to subdue your own anger is the practice of a bodhisattva. So understanding and reading these things and remembering them is really, really powerful. Yeah, it helps to support the change.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Cool. Yeah.
Thank you, Lama Kathy. I feel like you kind of covered a little bit of what I'm going to ask, but
it's okay.
So I had really big plans for yesterday with my two teen kids. Mm-hmm. And I had it just like this idea of the way things were going to go. Mm-hmm. It was going to be beautiful and perfect, and we were going to go do fun things. And then mm-hmm. everything fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody could agree on what they wanted to do. And I found myself, it's actually interesting that this was the discussion, because that version of hell you were talking about, like, that's where I feel like I was all day. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't, you know, my mind kept coming back to the only tool that I could think of was just like back to the breath.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. I feel like we were all spinning, and it was just suffering everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little bit worried you're going to tell me the answer is just to meditate more. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, we can always assume that we'll just like assume that, you know, but that's okay. But that's not the only answer. Okay.
But in moments where I'm still pretty new to this. So mm-hmm. in moments where there's just all of this suffering mm-hmm. and I don't feel like I have,
mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm doing it wrong. Like
I hear that.
All of it.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that.
Mm-hmm. I guess I just, in those moments, like yesterday, I'm a little bit confused about how to practice
I get
this.
It. No, I really, really get this. And I've learned a lot from the people in my life. Thank you for that question, because I totally agree. I totally agree. We need to have these little handholds, don't we? You know, something like what to do when things kind of go to heck, you know, when things just fall apart. I totally agree. Because, may I ask a question, and I'll repeat the answer so you don't have to run back up to the microphone. What do you think caused the pain that you felt, if you don't mind sharing? If you don't know, that's okay, but
I think it was the exit, it was fear and expectation.
Okay.
Older,
yeah, I get it. Really, yeah, yeah. Fear and expectation. I think that's really I think that's a really good call. That's a good insight that you had about that. And I've heard so many quotations about this sort of thing. You know, the perfect is the enemy of the good. You see what I'm saying? And like, I've heard these are not Buddhist sayings exactly, but they're like common wisdom, you know, common sense wisdom. And part of that is because when you have a perfect idea of something, you've actually already set the level for your disappointment. I just let that sink in a second. When you have an expectation, you have set the level of your disappointment. You've actually tripped the switch on your disappointment already. And then when it happens, you're like, see? So what's really interesting is I ran into a mom. I was astonished at this mom. She had much smaller children. This is not talk about teens, okay? And they were planning an outing, a day outing. And she did the most unusual thing. I'm sitting there because she was my host when I was teaching in Akron one time. And she has, I don't know, maybe three children. They were all, you know, young, like 10, age 10 and below. And she was preparing them for this trip. And she said, and she kind of almost said it in a sing-song voice, "We're going to the zoo. What do we do when we get to the zoo when the zoo is closed?" And then the kid said, "We'll go to the park." And she said, "We'll go to the park. That's a good idea. We'll go to the park. We'll go to the park. And if we go to the park and it rains," then they said, "Well, then we'll do this." And so it was a game that they obviously played often, which was it's basically a comic resetting of expectations. You know, because these things may happen. None of those things may happen. But the idea is to be flexible with what happens, and that being together is more important than what you do. Because if that becomes, so if there's like a resetting of expectations, that it's not about what you do together, but that you are together. Because that's really what it's about. Is that you spend time and that you enjoy each other. And so if before you go on outings like that, you can say, "Well, that last time was not my favorite time. I loved being with you, but I didn't like how I felt. So next time we go out, we'll do it differently." And then just make that the new plan. Does that make sense? But there's so much, I mean, there's so much of this kind of common sense wisdom that I've absorbed from like my dad and people like that. And my dad was a 12-step guy. So he would always have these phrases like first things first, meaning what is the most important thing in this moment? First things first. Then you do that most important thing first. And then you feel like you've done the most important thing. Then you can move on. And then another quote he gave me was, how important is it? How important is it? Because then you kind of examine to yourself, like, how important is that thing I'm doing? And then you say, oh, wait a minute. Okay, I see. There are other things that are more important. Like, or why am I holding on to this thing so tightly when I could just as easily do something else? Does that make sense? So common sense wisdom is actually kind of Dharma wisdom in a lot of ways. Personally, this is my personal opinion. I think the 12 step, the people who develop 12 step, I mean, it's not a perfect system. No system is perfect, but it's really helped a lot of people. It saved so many lives. It's not for everybody, but for the people it's for, it has saved lives. People have not died because of it. And I just think that that's bodhisattva activity. I think they qualify for bodhisattva. So these are the kinds of things you can do during the day when everything falls apart. You can kind of say, well, maybe we should just let the pieces fall and then see what we can do next. Like, what's next? You see what I'm saying? We're going to go to the zoo, and then the zoo is closed, and so forth. Yeah, and it's almost like we make that kind of arrangement with ourselves, and it's more about, you know, being easy about things and just being allowing about things. Does that make sense? Yeah. How important is it? Yeah. Well, it's now the bottom of the hour, so we have to stop here. But if anybody has questions that they didn't get to ask today, you can come afterwards and talk to me after, and I'll answer your questions then. I meant to stop at 12:25, but I kept talking. I mean, 12:25, and now it's 12:30, so sorry about that. We did tell the people at the synagogue we'd be out by 1. So in any case, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. And I want to tell you just a tiny bit of news in the few minutes I have. And that is, I just came back from seeing Kepo Carter Rinpoche. And he sends his regards. And he said, I've got some statues for you. And he said, he says, are you going to put the pillars and beams? And I said, well, we're trying to raise the money, Rinpoche, so we can put all the traditional Tibetan pillars and beams in the shrine room. He says, good, because I got all the banners and things that hang from it. He says, are you going to have a flat ceiling like KTD? And I'm like, no. And he says, oh. And I said, well, Rinpoche, you said to make it look like not like a Tibetan temple on the outside. So we made it kind of look more like an American church. So we've got that big ceiling. And he said, oh, okay. It'll work. We'll make it work. Anyway, but then he said, I've got all these statues and I've got all this stuff. He says, oh, by the way, he says, I'm going to send you a carload of Kempos and Lamas. The word Kempo means abbot. It's a level of training. It's like having a doctorate degree in Buddhism in our tradition. And he says, I'm going to send you a carload of them before you open the ground up. He says, because before you open the ground up, you gotta make offerings, because you know there's a lot of beings living in the ground, and you gotta pay them some respect. And there's a lot of beings living in the neighborhood, and the beings you can't see, and like the Native Americans said, there's a lot of other beings who are here we can't see, and you gotta be nice to them, and let them know that you're respecting them, and you're offering them respect, and you're gonna open the ground with their permission. And he said, you better get a tent because it's going to be all day. And he said, we're going to do one prayer text called the Ambrosia of the Moon. It's an offering. I don't know that I've ever done it. Then after that, we're going to do the smoke incense offering called Sang. And then after that, he listed more stuff. And then after that, it's lunch. And then after lunch, we're going to do the Protector Puja, Mahakali. We're going to do that. And so he said, you're going to need a tent. And I said, okay, we'll take care of it. And he said, I can't come on this visit. He said, but when you're ready to put the statues in, he said, I'll be there. I'll come for that. And he's 95 years old, by the way. And so he doesn't go much of anywhere now, but back and forth from Carmeling, where he lives, to KTD Monastery. So I'm so excited. We're going to see him. It's very exciting. And so he's very much looking forward to being part of this thing. I think he's so excited about this, the building of this. I said this thing, like this thing. Sometimes I can be so like anti-eloquent. This wonderful building that we're building for the sake of Dharma. I think he really feels it's going to be around for a long time. And he said, yeah, we're going to do two ceremonies, one with the lamas, with all the lamas. And he said, when you actually opened up the ground and then you put you do the original excavation, then you have to bury these treasure vases in the ground. He says, you and Lama Tom and Lama Wangdu, three of you can get down in the ground there and you can do it. And I'm like, oh God, how am I going to put me down there? Little old lady, how am I going to get down in the trench? Anyhow, we'll figure it out. And then he said, the last ceremony, there'll be three ceremonies, one before you open the ground, one when you place the treasure vases underneath that, you know, and then the last one will be when it's all dedicated. And so it's going to be quite a thing. I'm pretty jazzed about it. But in any case, I just wanted to share that news with you. So thanks for giving me a few minutes to, yay, I'm so excited, Rinpoche, so excited. Yeah. And he said, by the way, he also said, we're having trouble getting the funds that we need out of Asia. Maybe you can measure all the openings and have the shrine furniture made in China. And then our sponsors can sponsor it. And I'm like, okay. And then the next day I met the son of the family who makes the stuff. And I said, okay, I'm thinking dark wood, gold accents. He's like, oh yeah. He's from California, so he's really hip, you know. Anyway, so he was kind of jazzed. And I said, do you think you can make those like 16-foot tall pillars and beams? He said, yeah, I think we can do that. And I'm like, okay, we may have a deal here. So things are coming together, and so we're hoping that the groundbreaking or ground opening or whatever we're going to call it will be in the springtime, later in the spring. So let's sit and dedicate the goodness of our session today. Let's dedicate the goodness of this session to all suffering beings, but most especially those who are in one of the six states of existence now and are feeling great distress. Let's pray also for all the people who are bereaved, all the people who are frightened, all the people who have felt terror in their hearts in recent days. May all people be free and safe. And we'll dedicate the merit so that all beings gradually come to healthy spiritual paths, and may they come to awakening that pacifies all mental affliction. We'll mentally dedicate our goodness with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.